Penguin Random House Audio presents Sacrifice, A Gold Star Widow's Fight for the Truth by Michelle Black. Read for you by Brittany Presley. For Brian Black, Dustin Wright, LaDavid Johnson, Jeremiah Johnson, and their families, who deserved the truth. Also for the men who survived the ambush. May this book bring you the peace and justice you deserve. Author's note. Sacrifice is a work of nonfiction based upon events that occurred over the course of several years. My depictions of these events are based either on my own experiences or on interviews I conducted with surviving members of Green Beret Team 3212 and some of the mid-level and senior officers who were involved. I was unable to interview one of the survivors who was on assignment in the Middle East and did not interview two survivors who preferred not to be involved. The actions on the ground were pieced together from interviews with survivors, video taken by the headcam of J.W. Johnson, conversations with a member of the investigative team after the ambush, and narratives given by the military to survivors and to the families of the fallen. A copy of the redacted report provided to my family can be found at michelleblacksacrifice.com. Direct quotes found in this audiobook, including my own, are not verbatim but are intended to capture, to the best of my ability, the essence of what the speaker was saying based on the recollections of the people I interviewed. Some names have been changed to protect the privacy of service members. For example, those who remained on active duty after the incidents described herein. I have not changed the names of individuals whose names have appeared in the media in connection with the incidents. Prologue. The day my husband was buried, his casket pulled by six black horses, the sun shone brightly. With my boys on either side of me, I wept for their loss and for mine. I had always assumed that Brian and I would grow old together. Surely a folded flag was never meant to be mine. But here I was. 26 days earlier, 10 Green Berets fought a lethal battle on the ground in Niger, Africa, against ISIS militants. The ambush, which resulted in the death of my husband and three of his fellow soldiers, was the largest loss of American life in that region since the Battle of Mogadishu, also known as Black Hawk Down, in 1993. After being ambushed by an ISIS-affiliated group outside of the village of Tongo Tongo, six members of Green Beret Team 3212 would emerge alive, but forever changed. What most Americans remember about the Niger ambush, however, is the argument that erupted over a phone call between the President of the United States and one of the three widows. The poor handling of the phone call, coupled with a media firestorm and a handful of callous tweets, and the resulting feud, took the focus from the soldiers and placed it firmly on American politicians. Because of this, the four American and five Nigerian soldiers who died in the attack were forgotten within a couple of weeks. But not by us. Not by my family and the other families of the fallen. We were shocked by the attack and wanted to know how and why it had happened. Niger was not meant to be a dangerous assignment. Teams like my husband's conducted missions on the continent using a by, with, and through strategy to train their partner forces by having their partners take a lead role. Knowing this, we had questions about the ambush. Why was the team out near the Mali border by themselves with no backup and so poorly equipped? Who had made the decisions leading up to these terrible events? General Thomas D. Waldhauser, the commander of AFRICOM, United States Africa Command, quickly started an investigation to learn the facts surrounding the mission that led to the ambush. I knew there was a process to military investigations, and I was certain that the Army would probe every decision that led to this heartbreaking loss of life. I expected the story of the ambush would be simple, and the investigation truthful. However, over the months of waiting, I was surprised and confused by how the team was being treated. The Army referred to the Green Beret soldiers as a team that went rogue and acted like cowboys in order to go after a risky target, putting their lives and teammates in danger. They were disparaged in the media, and their captain was blamed and vilified for his decisions during the operation. I counted on the investigation's results to clear up my confusion. But after the family briefing in April 2018, I found that I had more questions than I'd had going in. I had thought the day my husband was buried, when my son saw him put in the ground, would be the worst thing I could survive. But somehow life had become less bearable. I needed to know the truth, to hear every detail of the ambush, to find out what AFRICOM had failed to tell us. What exactly happened to the men before, during, and after the ambush? The men of Team 3212 knew what had happened on the ground, but due to gag orders put in place by the military, they were not able to speak about it. I was faced with an overwhelming task, one that I had no idea how to begin. In late spring of 2018, I began talking with the remaining members of Green Beret Operational Detachment Alpha, ODA Team 3212. When the gag orders were lifted, many of the survivors came to my home one at a time and allowed me to record them as they told me every moment of those fateful 3 days. They answered every question. I wrote their story. Simply by listening to the men of ODA 3212 and not blaming them, I had earned their trust. That trust meant the world to me, and I knew I couldn't let them down. I had become the key to telling the true account of what happened in Niger. I often say I'd prefer to hear an ugly truth than a beautiful lie. In the year following my husband's death, I was told plenty of both. Sacrifice details many of the ugly truths I faced following the ambush and the lies I was told in the aftermath. It tells the story of what happened to ODA 3212 in October 2017 in Niger, and shows how that account differs from the official narrative. I have aimed to share that truth and to honor the men who lived it. Part 1. Life and Death. 1. Brian. Since the day Brian left for Niger, I'd had a horrible feeling deep inside. We'd been through several deployments and long separations, but none had made me as nervous as this one. In many ways, I enjoyed my routine when Brian was gone. I woke up early, got the kids to school, went jogging, worked on a house project. At night, when I wasn't reading or painting walls, I caught up on all the girl shows Brian hated, like The Bachelorette. I hadn't felt uneasy when he left on his 2 previous deployments, and neither of us had ever seen the need for long goodbyes. A quick hug and a kiss. I love you, and then see you in 6 months. But this time was different. I suppose some people would call it a premonition. Others would call it God's voice whispering to warn me. And others would say it was just my imagination. All I know is that as I stood at the curb of the small Fayetteville Regional Airport in North Carolina that sunny Saturday morning in August 2017, I desperately wanted to tell him to stay. For the first time in 6 years of watching him leave for training or deployments, I couldn't let him go. He seemed to feel the same way, pulling me in a second time for a stronger embrace. I began to tear up, which had never happened before, and he promised he'd be home soon. But he faltered as he picked up his bags and walked away, turning back for a second glance. He called out, "I love you. I'll call you as soon as I can." It was the last time I saw his handsome face, heard his deep voice, held him in my arms. I didn't feel right about letting him go that day, but there was nothing I could do to stop it. I was more in love with him than ever, and I willingly let him walk out of my life when every fiber of my being was screaming at me to stop him. But what could I have done? Who can stop the tide from going out, even if you know a tsunami is what it brings back in? So I let the army pull Brian out of my arms that day. I met Brian 15 years earlier in Mammoth Lakes, California, a ski town in the winter and a hiker's paradise in the summer. After graduating college, I'd wanted some time off from reality to have fun. I learned I had epilepsy after having a seizure my first day of college classes, and it had taken me longer than expected to graduate as I adjusted to taking daily medication and managing my condition. When I treated it correctly, I could completely prevent my seizures. But I could not party, go without sleep, or take on heavy loads of schoolwork like most college students. Upon graduation, I was proud to have proved to myself what I could do, but I was ready for a break. I went skiing. Every morning, I'd walk a mile to the village.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?